Tammy and John Turturro this week on Ask Me Another.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Later this hour, we will hear tributes and reflections about the late Maya Angelou, the beloved poet, writer, who died this morning at the age of 86. But first, we return to this very disturbing story out of Santa Barbara, the shooting of a number of people this weekend. We want to get a different perspective that you might not have heard, but we think you will want to. And if you've taken time to read the so-called manifesto of the shooter, Elliot Rodger, then you know that it's filled with anger and frustration. But what exactly was he angry about? Yes, he says he was angry about not having a girlfriend, but his obsessions were also very much tied up in his ideas about race and masculinity. Jeff Yang did a deep dive into this. He writes about media for the Wall Street Journal. He recently wrote a piece called What a Close Reading of the Isla Vista Shooter's Horrific Manifesto, My Twisted World, says about his values and ours. And he's with us from New York. Jeff Yang, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hey, Michelle. Always great to be here.
Now, I understand that you said you really didn't want to closely examine this manifesto. You really didn't want to write about it and give those ideas any more air, but you felt that you had to. Why did you feel that you had to?
Well, you know, in looking at the headlines and much of the ways in which this shooter, Elliot Rodger, was being discussed, the terminology is being used, sort of the typical, loner white boy shooter, et cetera, young white man driven because of envy and mental illness. It just struck me as being a little bit off, and more than a little bit, in fact. I'm not sure whether this is just something that, as an Asian American, you kind of end up having this visual sensitivity towards it. But looking at this picture, it was clear to me that he was not, in fact, quote-unquote, white, that there was something else going on.
And that you feel like that's something going on is something that you really want to talk about. I want to focus on that. You said that his identity, that he's biracial, the son of a British-born filmmaker, Peter Rodger, who's best known as the second unit director of The Hunger Games, but also a woman who's a Lee Chin Rodger, a Malaysian Chinese nurse for film productions. And you said that his racial identity played a, quote, deeper and darker role in his pathology than anybody's been discussing. How so?
Well, when you actually read his manifesto, and reading it, it makes you want to take a bath afterwards. It's just so full of hatred, both at himself and others. You can see how deeply his notion of race and his self-hatred, essentially, colored just about everything else in his life, and perhaps most notably the way he looked at women and at sexual relationships. There's a deep sense in which his not-quite-whiteness ends up pervasively filtering, being sort of the lens in which he looks at the world. And it's truly troubling, I mean, not least of which is because it showed the degree to which the badge of whiteness ends up becoming such a challenging thing for men of color in general, even those who are multiracial, maybe especially those who are multiracial, to have to negotiate as adolescents and as young men.
Well, you know, he talks about that. He's talked specifically in one point about how he dyes his hair in order to be fully white. He dyes his hair blonde, and his parents indulge him in this, perhaps not, you know, thinking very much of it, that, you know, they're in Hollywood, so they're around film, that people change their appearance. Maybe it's not a big deal. But he expresses it very much as a desire to be white.
He does indeed. In fact, he actually uses the term normal white boys or normal white kids. And his notion that if he dyes his hair blonde, he changes a sort of external feature, that he'll be accepted, that he'll be celebrated, that he'll be quote-unquote cool, it's something which he talks about at length. And of course it doesn't work, at least not for very long.
You know, also tied up in his elevation of whiteness is his dislike, as he expresses it, for people who aren't white, and especially African-Americans and, as he puts it, Mexicans. And he talks about his resentment and rage when he sees somebody who's African-American or Latino with a white girl. He's very clear that, I mean, these are some very ugly comments, so I don't know that I want to go into sort of great detail about it, but he makes it very clear that he thinks these people are less than him. And I just wanted to ask what you make of all that.
It is gut-wrenching. I mean, reading what he has to say, specifically in the context of men of color, African Americans, Hispanics, and even Asians, what he calls full-blooded Asians, when he sees them with women, when he sees them with white women, with white blonde women, his own object of fetish, if you will, and obsession, he is disgusted. He is enraged. He speaks about them as lesser beings and wonders why it is that they get this kind of sexual or social attention when he, this being who is descended from British royalty, at least in part, has not had this advantage. It's troubling, and it in some ways places a real lens on the very notions of race and how it interplays with our gender identities and our interactions on a social basis.
And speaking of that, you know, recently more people have been talking about, but you know, people in the media, people who are involved in culture, actors, for example, have been talking about the way certain groups are kind of positioned in the culture. And, you know, Asian women have been speaking out about this, but now Asian men have too. And one of the things that has been discussed recently is this whole question of whether the Asian American man who's typically depicted in the culture is effeminized, right? He's not viewed as kind of the guy's guy or as a kind of a male role model type person. And I wonder whether that played some role in this from what you saw in his writing. Do you think that factored into this?
Oh, it certainly did. I mean, he speaks extensively about being shorter, about being slighter, about not being, you know, physical in the same ways that especially taller white athletes around him are, and how that in some ways makes him feel inferior or less capable of attracting women, as if women are the way to keep score, so to speak, of your masculinity. I think it's something that for Asian men, well, it's certainly a stereotype. There is a perception somehow that Asian men physically do not, if you will, meet these conventional standards of masculinity. But I think on some level, the real thing we should be questioning is whether those should be, in fact, the standard of masculinity, whether physical prowess or height or size, and especially the ability to sort of keep score by having sexual conquests, is what we should be teaching men is a marker of masculinity.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, if you would. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Jeff Yang. We're talking about his close read of the Elliot Rogers, the Santa Barbara shooter's horrific manifesto. And he's writing about, in his reflections on this, you talk a lot about movies that you yourself enjoy, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Revenge of the Nerds. But you also talk about the fact that they kind of create this kind of hierarchy of sexuality. And what do you mean by that? And what would you like us to be thinking about that?
Well, as somebody who is a self-proclaimed and at this point fairly proud nerd, if you will, you grow up in a setting in which a lot of the things that people and that mass media especially celebrates about guys, you know, this notion that somehow, you know, if you are able to win the attention of an attractive woman, that somehow validates you as a man. When you actually look at the canon, especially of young adult male films, of these sort of coming-of-age movies, some of the ones you mentioned, but, you know, honestly, there are dozens and dozens of these, they're very focused around this idea that even people who don't meet up to that physical ideal somehow can and should be racing after that ultimate prize, that, you know, even nerds can get a beautiful girl if they do X, Y, and Z.
And beautiful being very narrowly defined, by the way.
Oh, well, absolutely.
In fact, there's that.
I think that one of the most troubling aspects of reading this manifesto is the degree to which Elliot Rogers talks about this sort of golden girl archetype of the tall, sexy, white, blonde girl. And frankly, growing up, watching some of these films, just growing up in America in general, that really is an avatar that's placed in front of us. That is something which, you know, growing up I said, wow, you know, that woman's beautiful because she is X, Y, and Z, white, blonde, tall, et cetera. And that's a big part of the problem.
You know, it's interesting that there's already been kind of a furious kind of Hollywood pushback on even the suggestion that these kinds of images play some role in this. And obviously, I think it's important to point out that this young man clearly was struggling with some mental illness. I think there's some documented evidence of that. I think his family's been open about that. But the Washington Post movie critic Anne Hornaday wrote about these movies where the schlubby nerd guy gets the girl, the blonde girl, and that's the prize. And she specifically named some films by Seth Rogen, who furiously responded saying, you know, that you're just trying to sell papers, and very sort of angry about that. But I do wonder whether you think there's any opportunity to talk about what kinds of messages are being sent to people about what they're supposed to want and how they're supposed to behave if they don't get it. You, as a person who's immersed in this culture, you write about media and movies and other cultural things all the time. Is there any openness to talking about that?
There is, and there should be. I mean, I respect to a certain extent where Seth Rogen is coming from. I mean, you know, nerds everywhere, there's a sense of, I don't know, a sense of some kind of, you know, a change in the weather where, you know, over the course of, say, the last 10, 15 years, we have kind of come into our own, that there are professions, there are, you know, individuals who have become celebrated in society despite the fact that we don't, again, match up with those physical ideals or conventional ideals. At the same time, again, that conversation has to happen. Do we become validated simply by embracing the same goals, the same rewards, the same, you know, standards of masculinity, just with a different position that we're coming from? I think that actually Arthur Chu, the Jeopardy champion, who has since taken to writing for the Daily Beast and other places, has a terrific piece in the Daily Beast today about this notion that nerds very often are only separated by jocks, you know, in terms of how we look, but in many cases have the same kinds of misogynistic context and viewpoints, and that's really troubling.
Well, thank you for writing this piece. I'll be interested to hear what kind of reaction you get to it. That was Jeff Yang. He writes about media for the Wall Street Journal. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us. We reached him in New York.
Thank you, Michelle.
We hope you'll stay with us as we take a visit to the beauty shop. The ladies there will reflect on the violence in Santa Barbara, and we'll talk about the hashtag activism of Yes, All Women. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Community Cinema, the documentary film The New Black takes viewers into the pews and onto the streets as it tells the story of the historic fight to win marriage equality in Maryland and charts the evolution of this divisive issue within the black community. I'm Sean Powers with Illinois Public Media News. Join me for the free public screening and panel discussion at the Spurlock Museum on Tuesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. Free garage and street parking is available.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. For 26 years, 10,000 Villages has been offering fairly traded gift items for family and friends, from coffee, tea, and chocolate to a collection of personal accessories and home decor.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for a visit to the beauty shop, where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's news. And later, we are going to save some time to talk about Maya Angelou. We want to hear the reflections of this panel of writers, all of whom have important memories to share of their connection with her work. But we want to continue discussing the story we started with this morning. It's a difficult story, and we understand that it may be disturbing for some listeners, but we think that we have some important insights that we want to share about this as well. As we mentioned earlier, a 22-year-old college student named Elliot Roger went on a violent rampage over the weekend that left six people dead before he apparently killed himself. Roger fatally stabbed his three roommates and then shot 13 people, fatally wounding three on and around the University of California Santa Barbara campus. He left this 140-page manifesto, as he called it, that detailed what he felt were injustices, that women specifically were not paying attention to him or having sex with him. He posted a video before the rampage detailing his plans and his motivations. And here's a short clip. And I do want to say once again, we do recognize this will be upsetting to many people.
Girls gave their affection and sex and love to other men, but never to me. I'm 22 years old, and I'm still a virgin. I've never even kissed a girl. It's not fair. You girls have never been attracted to me. I don't know why you girls aren't attracted to me, but I will punish you all for it.
Now, we want to say once again that it has been reported that Roger had been seen by counselors and psychiatrists for various mental issues throughout his life. And we just heard from media writer Jeff Yang, who talked about how his views around masculinity and race are part of this pathology. Now we want to hear from Ann Ishii, and we want to hear from Kelly Goff. Ann Ishii is the editor-in-chief of They're All So Beautiful. That's an online forum that looks at race and dating. Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. Mickey Kendall is a writer and media critic with HoodFeminism.com. And Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media, a conservative libertarian news and commentary site. And they've all been writing about this. So, Ann, I'm going to start with you. As we mentioned earlier, he talked about race a lot. In this manifesto, and I wanted to ask how you this all struck you, Anne. Well, we can't. For some reason, we're missing Anne. So let's talk with Bridget Johnson, who's here in our Washington, D.C. studios. How did this strike you, Bridget Johnson?
Well, I think it's highly frustrating because when these incidents keep happening, and everybody says afterwards,
"You can hear me, right?"
We're going to focus on mental health from now on. And then every time it happens again, the mental health side of it seems to get washed under the rug. You know, I read one piece on HuffPo that said that whether or not he was mentally ill is not the point. It's exactly the point. I looked at this video and this manifesto, and I saw a sociopath. And he was also, you know, saying a lot of things that he wanted to be taken at face value. When we look at somebody like Dylan Klebold from Columbine, and he claimed that he had no friends and had no social life, but investigators actually found out that his social calendar was pretty full. If a sociopath wants to become a martyr, he needs sympathizers. He tapped well into this men's rights movement to do it. But, you know, I found a really interesting article on Psychology Today talking about how parents and counselors are so not wanting to even address this sociopath label, even though there's different ends of it on a spectrum, just like autism. And this writer said that it's a damaging trend with parents, with psychologists and counselors, in pretending all of their problems stem linearly from depression or trauma or ADHD alone. So until we start naming these things as they actually are, then they're not going to get the treatment that stops these things from happening in the future.
And what about you?
Can we hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
I was just going to say that, of course, as a woman, it's really haunting to be listening to this guy's video and all of that, but I have to say what makes it extra haunting personally is that as an Asian American, I can actually kind of identify with the anguish this guy feels, and the hatred is directed definitely towards women, but certainly toward himself, and as Jeff pointed out in your earlier segment, toward Asians. It should be noted, of course, that, you know, the first three people he killed were his Asian roommates, stabbing them, which is so visceral. And I also just, you know, gleaned the manifesto to the extent that I could. It's quite long and disturbing, but he talks a lot about, you know, comparing the riches of the successful white male against sort of the anguish that his Asian mother had to go through of, you know, being denied certain forms of alimony and moving into a condominium after living in a mansion. And, you know, it's tied into this idea of, he's not good enough to be white, but isn't even sure what he is as an Asian man. And I think there's a lot to be said about that for sure.
Mickey, what about you? Mickey Kendall?
So one of the things that bothers me around a lot of the narratives here is that we seem to think that he approached women, that women turned him down, that women and even his roommates really interacted with him in a negative way. In fact, by all accounts, he never tried to speak to anyone. He refused to accept things said by the counselors. He's had access to the best help, the best care, the best schools possible. This is, I think, a story not just about mental illness, because to be honest, most mentally ill people are more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence, so much as it is a story about his hatred of people for having things he could not have. These attacks before he became overtly physically violent, when he was throwing lattes at girls on the bus stop and all of these, you know, getting angry about the black friend of the roommates for having a white girlfriend. This is a story that says to me that we've got to start talking about the weapons he was able to access, the ways in which he was able to move around and do these things, because he was broadcasting his hate for a long time. The police were even called. They found him perfectly normal and charming.
You know, Bridget was saying that what concerns her is she feels we're still minimizing the kind of profound effects that mental illness can have on people. Mickey, I hear you saying is you think we're still minimizing what? The effect that kind of extreme racism is and how profound that can be, or extreme misogyny? I guess I'm asking, what do you think you want us to be thinking about here?
I want us to be thinking about the extreme misogyny and about the extreme, because were this framed in another way, we would be talking about terrorism, right? That's what this was about. He has a manifesto. He had a target. He had a plan to go and kill a whole room full of women in a whole house full of women, actually.
And he had
there's
the whole
not much connection between him and his victim. Yes.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm going to annihilate this whole group of people. He went on to say he wanted to put them all in a concentration, women all in a concentration camp. I mean, it's truly, truly chilling stuff. Talk to us briefly about this hashtag and the hashtag, yes, all women. As a person who's been very active in kind of using social media to draw attention to issues. Mickey, what do you feel is the point of this hashtag, and why do you think it's taken off so much?
I think it's taken off because, yes, we all know that not all men can be violent, but yes, all women have reasons to be afraid. Yes, all women have reasons to be concerned. And at some point, we've also got to start talking about misogyny not as this thing that is a fluke, because he clearly found people who agree with him. He clearly found people who think he's a hero. There are multiple fan pages devoted to Elliot Rodgers on Facebook and other forms of social media. We have to start talking about misogyny as a serious societal ill that can kill.
Kelly Goff, you were telling us that you're not a fan of hashtag activism. Tell me why, and then give us your other thoughts about this.
Well, look, I'm a fan of anything that does get people discussing something on Twitter besides Kim and Kanye's wedding, and particularly something more substantive. So in that regard, you know, do I think it can be beneficial in shifting the conversation? Sure. Do I think it's beneficial in the ways that if all the people who were doing hashtag activism actually voted or wrote letters to their members of Congress or actually gave donations to specific organizations doing specific work? No, I don't see it as particularly beneficial, except for creating platforms for people who want more attention for themselves, particularly in social media. Now, you know, and the thing, I care about the issues that this whole conversation has raised. I care deeply about misogyny. I care deeply about the fact that even in this day and age, you can't walk down the street in New York without someone saying something unsolicited or touching you in an unsolicited way. But the fact of the matter is, his first victims were men. Mm. I mean, his first victims were men. And so what's frustrating for me, Michelle, is the first thing I think about this story when I think about it, and I've been thinking about it a lot, is my heart goes out to the victims. But the second thing is how frustrated I am at the political jockeying that always takes place after these tragedies, where everyone tries to co-opt it for its cause before we even have all the necessary information. And that's been so typical with the story.
Does that apply to the father of one of the victims who came out very strong, Mr. Martinez? Came out very strongly saying that he thinks this is about politicians not doing their job and reflecting the will of the people when it comes to restricting access to guns. Do you feel that that applies to him?
A firm rule that I have as a journalist, and I've stuck to this, is I never judge victims of violence in wherever they are emotionally. Mm. I do not think I have the moral high ground to do so, and I won't.
Mm. But as to the rest of us, what would you want us to be thinking about when it comes to this?
Well, before the finger pointing started, which I realize we now live in this internet age where, you know, if something happens 5 minutes later, your editor wants to know where the piece is, right? And that's part of the problem, because then we all have to take it. We feel like we have to take an angle. I've tried to sort of free myself from feeling that in some cases, because I feel like I've probably been guilty of jumping the gun. No, excuse me for the poor choice of words, but on certain stories before we all had the information. So I'm trying to get a little bit better about that. I'd like to see all of us actually try to get a little better about that before the first piece goes up blaming Hollywood, blaming misogyny, blaming lack of gun control. I mean, especially because his first victims were killed with knives. Mm. So, I mean, there's a lot. I just wish we could kind of slow the process down, even though I realize the genie is out of the bottle at this point. But that's what I would actually love to see happen. And then once we have more information, have the really substantive conversation start. I know I'm rambling, but the last thing I want to say is I'd love to see people actually go back and do something a month later, as opposed to then dropping the topic after the hashtag activism dies down.
Yes, but speaking of the hashtag activism, the fact that the stuff that emerges in the wake of something about this, you have to look at it as being having some meaning. And Bridget Johnson, I'm thinking about, so there was the hashtag yes all women, and it got a tremendous response. And then some people responded to the hashtag with their own hashtag not all men. But there were some really disturbing comments and remarks attached to that. I feel like I have to say one of them about, just because I feel like I need to, for some people to understand the tenor of this, which was, you know, what do you say to a woman with two black eyes? Not much. She's already not listened twice. What's up with that?
Yeah.
What's up with that?
I saw that on a, shall I say, competitor conservative site.
A competitor conservative site, yes. A competitor conservative site, yes. Yes, it was.
But it's just so ugly because, you know, it draws out this alpha male frustration, you know, with not being able to control women. And, you know, everybody, every woman who tweeted something, you know, has dealt some way, you know, with, you know, having to, you know, pretend that she has a boyfriend so that a guy can back off, you know, et cetera. You know, I had two attempted sexual assaults in college that I fended off. You know, one was a friend, you know, who turned suddenly angry when I repelled his advances. So I'm really kind of disgusted, I guess, with the tract that the hashtag has taken, and the pushback against it. You know, if people would just settle down and listen for a minute about, you know, what people's experiences are, even if they're not directly connected to a mentally ill person doing this shooting and stabbing.
And I want to also want to say
but I do want to give us some time to talk about Maya Angelou. I don't want to forget that opportunity to give some reflections upon that. You want to just give a brief thought? Mickey, just
It's a very brief thought. It's literally just in terms of hashtag activism, it always, this is the beginning. This is not all that happens. So there's a process to start any movement, and you have to talk about it before you can do anything.
Let's spend a couple of minutes, three minutes or so that we have left, talking about Maya Angelou. And Anne, do you want to start?
Yeah, you know, it's a huge loss, And I just remember being in high school and being in a rink-a-dink poetry club, and it was really, you know, a bunch of misfits, probably actually not unlike these nerds we've been talking about all week in regards to being sort of secluded and lonely, but you know, I found so much solace in poetry, but most importantly, just a really profound moment of reading Maya Angelou's work and realizing that women were actually superior at poetry, and that gave me a sense that this was actually a format that that we not only could embrace but could be really proud of. And, you know, I was totally disillusioned by having to understand sonnets and Robert Frost and to be introduced to powerful female verse. I think it's appropriate, actually, that we're talking about hashtag activism. I think we've made it clear that women really are the owners of this, of verse.
Yeah, it is a great loss. We're going to hear from Nikki Giovanni in just a few minutes, but first I wanted to ask any of you if you have any other thoughts to share. Bridget, do you have any other thoughts to share briefly about Maya Angelou?
Well, my might seem a little bit trivial, especially considering the gravity of the work I'm referencing, but it's because of her I don't cage any of my birds. I think that they should be free and, you know, and not frustrated and sitting in their little cage singing, so they have free access.
All right. I know why the cage bird sings. What about you,
Michelle?
Mickey?
Oh,
Kelly, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I don't come from a family that has had a ton of money, right? But one of the things I give my parents so much gratitude for is that they made sure to do what they could to expose me to things that would allow me to dream as big as possible. And one of the things they did is they pulled enough money together to make sure we as a family could attend the 1993 inauguration of Bill Clinton. And that was really the first time I was exposed to a black female poet, a woman who was changing the world with her words. And I now look at the career path I ended up on, which I, you know, none of us really predicted. And I really believe that that moment and moments like it had a profound effect in shaping me and allowing me to dream that I could be a writer.
Thank you for that. Mickey, final thought from you.
I would just want to say that in sixth grade, I had a family upbringing that's not too different from Dr. Maya Angelou's. It was complicated. And my teacher gave me a copy of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And I was in a place where I could have gone left or I could have gone right. And in a lot of ways, reading that book and seeing the life that she made for herself and going on to read her other work helped me make the right decisions to get to a good place as an adult, even though I was coming from a dark place as a child.
Thank you for that. Thank you all so much for sharing those personal reflections. Mickey Kendall is a writer and media critic with hoodfeminism.com with us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. And Ishi is editor-in-chief of They're All So Beautiful. Kelly Goff is a columnist for The Root and The Daily Beast. They both joined us from our bureau in New York. Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, America has lost one of its most distinctive voices in literature and life. We mark the passing of poet Maya Angelou, and we hear from her longtime friend, the fellow acclaimed writer and poet Nikki Giovanni. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CNN with the new original series, The 60s, The Decade That Changed the World, premieres Thursday night at 9 on CNN. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, with a live chat on women and cancer, Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. cancercenter.com/hangout. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
The Cannes Film Festival, the most important international film festival, concluded over the weekend. On The Next Fresh Air, we talk about some of the films that won awards and that incited the deepest disagreements with our critic-at-large, John Powers, who was at Cannes. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan. This summer, the Little Theater on the Square presents 42nd Street, Big River, The Sound of Music, Little Shop of Horrors, Legally Blonde, and more. Ticket information is available at 217-728-7375.
Coming to WILL-TV, the My Music series presents its first big band music retrospective featuring the biggest songs that got us through World War II and kickstarted the baby boom. Hosted by Peter Marshall, this nostalgic program brings you a mix of live, rare, and unreleased footage featuring the original hitmakers and brassy legends from the big band days. Watch The Big Band Years, Saturday night at 6 on WILL-TV.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to pay tribute now to the legendary author and poet Maya Angelou. She died this morning at the age of 86. Here is a clip of her reading part of one of her most beloved poems, Phenomenal Woman.
Many people wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally.
With us to share more about Maya Angelou's remarkable life and legacy is Nikki Giovanni. She is a celebrated author and poet in her own right, and she was a friend of Maya Angelou's for more than 40 years. Welcome back to the program. I'm sorry this under such sad circumstances today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I must say, in all fairness, this Maya's passing is not a shock.
Oh.
And, you know, we've known that it's only been her phenomenal will, speaking of phenomenal, that has kept her active. Many a lesser person, you know, considering her health, it's not her age, but her health, would have given up. But Maya lived every moment. I've had to laugh recently that, and a couple of hours ago, I said, I don't know anybody, and I really don't, who has gotten as much out of life as Maya Angelou.
You know, speaking of which, she has such an amazing story. I mean, which she's written about, I mean, you know, born in 1928 in St. Louis, raised in St. Louis and mm-hmm. Stamps, Arkansas. She did not speak for much of her childhood mm-hmm. after she was molested and after the perpetrator was killed, and then became this amazing artist. I mean, the fact that people think of, like, the fact that she was the first African-American woman member of the Directors Guild, right? The fact that she went overseas as a performer. When you think of her, what's the first thing you think of?
Laughter. That's the truth, laughter. And she and I had, we were not competitors in terms of poetry, but we were competitors in terms of food. And as, you know, Maya moved here, and I'm saying here because it's the South, to Winston-Salem, and that's only a three-hour drive, two and a half if I was in a hurry. And I would go down, and she would have her people, she directed, because she had a breathing problem. And so she would have, you know, Miss Chris or one of her people fix lunch, but she would say, you know, a little salt, they'd have to bring things to her. And I said to her, you know, you're better known and all of those things, but I'm a better cook, Maya. She said, you are not a better cook. And I took my friend Joanne Gavin, who is the director of Furious Flower Poetry Center. She's here in James Madison. And we went down and we made dinner for Maya. It was too funny. I mean, we had such a good time because, of course, Joanne makes this really great, it's called a blueberry buckle. And, you know, it's like a pudding. And so Maya was going to be polite to Joanne, and she was like, okay, Joe, this is really good buckle, Joe. But she said, Nick, I made a rack of lamb. She said, well, I think it's a little overdone. I had to laugh.
you know, one of the things you're speaking to, though, is her generosity. I mean, to many, many people. I mean, that's another word that comes up. And I was reading, you know, Facebook tributes, and I'm reading one from a man who had been sent to record her at her home, record her poetry. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how scared he was. And he went and he said he had one of the most inspiring and healing experiences of his life. He spent 4 days at her home because she wouldn't let him stay at a hotel. And she cooked every night.
Yeah.
Amazing cook. And actually let her direct her recording her own work. I mean, where did that come from?
I don't know. I think she had a difficult childhood at the beginning, and I think that the silence allowed her to absorb good stories because she really had an incredible ear, as you know. She spoke, what, five languages? Mm-hmm. And she could hear it, and she could absorb it and reproduce it. But I think she also recognized joy was important. I don't, I can't remember it. I've known Maya over 30 years. I don't remember her, you know, some people pettily gossip and things. I just don't remember her doing that. I've only heard her speak ill of one person, and that was well deserved.
Oh, dear.
I'm not going to go any further
with
that. I mean, when you think about it, you know, because, you know, we're in a competitive business. But she's always been generous. We came down, we being Virginia Tech, I teach at Tech, and I brought a busload of kids down to see the Romare Bearden exhibit down in Winston-Salem. And she said, well, you have to come by. Well, I thought coming by that we would stop it by her house and sing a Christmas carol. It was doing just before the holiday season. So the kids and I, the young college students and I, practiced, you know, a Christmas carol. We were going to, you know, we wish you a Merry Christmas and stand out in front of the house. But she had made lemonade and cookies, and she invited us in, and she told us stories. It was just wonderful. I mean, and she just did that. And I think that she always reminded, if I may use that term, she always reminded herself that joy is important. So she wanted to receive it, and the best way to receive it is to give it.
You know, I had the privilege of speaking with her a couple of times for this program. And one time I'm thinking of back in 2010, and here she is talking about writing, especially writing the truth. Here mm-hmm. it is.
You know, there's a world of difference between facts and the truth. You can have so many facts that you don't deal with the truth. You never get to the truth. You have the places where, the people who, the times when, the reasons why, the methods how, blah, blah. And never get to the human truth. The human truth is as elusive as the air and as important as the air.
You want to talk a little bit more about that?
Being a poet, I couldn't agree more that there's a lot of difference between facts and truth, because there's an old mathematical problem that we can prove that the arrow does not move. I don't know if they get that when you were in school. When I was in school, it was a mathematical problem. And we proved that though you can put the arrow in the bow and you let it go, we can prove that the arrow does not move, because a thing, as we know mathematically speaking, can only occupy one place at one time. So once we put the arrow in another place, it cannot move. It is actually not moving. It is occupying one place at one time. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. And that's what I think that Maya was talking about. And I think, again, that's her life. I mean, I just always appreciated the verve with which she lived her life. She did everything 100%. You know, everything 100%. So that's a good thing. So if she fell in love, she got married. When she fell out of love, she got divorced. You know. But I love that about her, because she wasn't always trying to justify something, you know?
You know, it's funny, to that end, and if you're just joining us, we are honoring the poet and activist Maya Angelou, who died today at the age of 86. We are speaking with the also renowned poet, writer, Professor Nikki Giovanni, who's offering her reflections. You know, she was tough. I mean, her writing was very tough, and it's interesting how uplifting many people experience it, because if you think about it, she was writing about some things that a lot of people didn't talk about, like the being molested, for example, and also the struggle to get an education, and also some of the dynamics within her family that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily want to talk about at a time when a lot of people did not write about those things. Mm-hmm. And she then, a couple of years ago, she donated her papers to the Schomburg Collection, and I asked her, I said, well, you know, do you have any trepidation about your notes and your thoughts and revealing your thought process as you're crafting the work? And I just said, you know, I don't know why I bothered. I don't know why I said this. I said, I'm not sure I'd want anybody to see my rough drafts of things before they appear. And she said, I don't have that kind of vanity.
Yeah, I think that's true.
She said, I have no modesty. Modesty is a learned affectation. It's just like a decal stuck up on a person.
I think she's pretty modest. I'm going to disagree with that. And I am fortunate. I know all of her people. And Maya's been in and out of the hospital, and I'm sure these records are going to show up. I'm not saying something that, you know, is unknown. But you could call down and you could say, well, everybody called her Doc, you know, what's Doc doing? And Lydia would say, Doc's, you know, she can't come to the phone right now. She's getting her hair done, yak, yak, yak. And one of the reasons, she was in the hospital, but she didn't want to tell. And that's a modesty. She didn't want people feeling sorry for her. This is what I'm saying. And so she didn't, a lot of that, and a lot of the discomfort of her illness, she didn't share. You know, she wasn't one of those people that's going to whine. As she said, if I'm alive, I'm I'm well, and if I'm not alive, then, you know. But I have to say this, if I may.
Sure.
The one thing that I know Maya, if she could do it, would want is to know what's being said about her now in her death. I know if she could stand someplace and hear it, she would get the biggest kick, you know.
How come?
Because we all want to, and I don't want to put something on. But you want to know what people say when they don't think that you can find out that they've said it. And we all love her, but you writers don't ever feel that. I think actors are probably the most insecure people on earth, but writers come real close. And I know, and I think you could talk to anybody that knows her, that if there's one thing that we could do for her, just putting her in a spot so that she can hear what we're saying. You know, we did that with Toni Morrison 2 years ago. I went down to see Maya because Slade, Toni's son, died. And I said, we should do something, don't you think, for Toni? And she immediately said, yes. And what we did was actually, if I can use that word, we eulogized Toni. And we talked about what Toni meant to us, and we had a celebration here at Virginia Tech where we had everybody, we had a bunch of actors and actresses read Toni's words back to her. India Arie had written a song from Bluest Eye, you know, I'm Not Afraid of the Dark. I mean, we did all of that. So we did what we would have done if Toni had passed. And Maya was saying, wow, you know, that's what we would do if she'd pass. And so I heard that, and she's bigger than that, so there was no way that we could really put her with that. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But I know, and I'm smiling, because I'm going to miss Maya, and we all are. But I know that if there was a way to just sit her on a cloud and let her hear, she would get the biggest kick. She'd just be sitting in that chair with a glass of wine, if it's 11 o'clock, a glass of white wine, and laughing and talking.
What would you like us to think about as we think about her today and going forward?
I think you have to think about her really great spirit. I just don't think, I mean, I love Phenomenal Woman. I love Caged Bird. She has really good cookbooks, too. You know, as I said, we're all foodies. But I think if I had a daughter, which I was not privileged, I have a son, though he could learn from that, too. But I would want to say to my daughter, you know, this is one of the great spirits. Maya had an embrace of life. And it's rare, you know. And even I like being alive, but even I don't come anywhere near this, that joy that she brought, that he woke me. There's an old Negro spiritual. He woke me up this morning and started me on my way. The Lord is blessing me. And I don't know anybody who thinks that but Maya. I mean, of all of the people that I know, I don't know anybody who has just that verve, that I'm alive. And as long as I'm alive, she used to say that all the time. I say, you know, and then you back her. Well, she says, you know, as long as I'm here, it feels good. And that's the way she's going to look at it.
All right. Well, Nikki Giovanni, thank you so much for speaking with us on this bittersweet day, let's say it that way.
It truly is.
Nikki Giovanni is an award-winning author and a poet, joining us with her reflections about Maya Angelou, who passed away this morning. And Nikki Giovanni, we reached her at her home in Virginia, where she's a professor at Virginia Tech. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. And smile when you think of her.
Finally today, a brief word from me. And since this is a day when we are mourning the loss of the consummate storyteller Maya Angelou, I will start by telling you a story. You might remember that before I came to NPR, I worked at ABC News, for the most part for the late-night program Nightline, anchored by Ted Koppel. And I was thinking about a story he sent me to cover about a high-ranking African-American police officer from Miami who got into an altercation with a white cop from Orlando. This was after the Orlando officer pulled the Miami officer over, who was on his way to his vacation house. And when I say altercation, I mean fists were thrown and words were exchanged that did not include "we shall overcome." The whole thing captured on the Orlando officer's dashboard camera. Well, because the traffic stop seemed kind of profile-y, and because there was an arrest, and because the Miami officer was a big shot, the matter clearly was headed to somebody's courtroom. So neither of the principals, the black cop or the white cop, would talk to me. But each side had credible representatives who would. So I sat down with each separately, and we went over the dashboard video, beginning to end, to try to understand what led to such an ugly confrontation between two grown men in the same line of work. Can I just tell you, it probably won't shock you to know that often what happens after you stop rolling is just as interesting as whatever comes before. I don't think I'm breaking anybody's confidence to tell you that after all the sound bites were said and after the cables were rolled up and the cameras put away, both men at some point took me aside to ask in voices of genuine wonderment, "Can you tell me why this happened? Why did that guy react that way?" So in all honesty, that's kind of where I got the idea for Tell Me More. What happened to me on that assignment happened more times than I can recount. Now, it's true that some people just want their 15 minutes of fame, and it's true that some people just want votes and don't much care what they have to say to get them, and it's true that some people just don't have much use for anybody who's different. But in my experience, an awful lot of people really do want to know, why did that just happen? Why did that guy react that way? What is this all about? Or they just want to tell somebody why they feel or believe or react as they do. They want to be seen. They want to be heard. This feels especially urgent in a time when many people feel invisible, or they feel that everything they care about is changing, things like who their neighbors are or what language they speak or who gets to marry whom. Or they feel that things aren't changing fast enough and they wonder why. And it's always been interesting to me how often people who live in the same town or in the same city don't really talk to each other until something happens, a Gina Six, a Trayvon Martin, and then everybody starts talking at once. So I thought it would be good to have a place where people could talk about these issues calmly, usually, with civility always, but on the regular and not just when something bad happens, like when there's credible new knowledge to share about issues that people have just had assumptions about, when there are real facts to bring insight to real issues, when new leaders emerge from places we haven't seen before, when something changes in the way people are thinking about an issue, or just when there's something fun that you might not have heard about because it involves people you don't already know. And yeah, sometimes when something bad happens, because that's part of life too. That's why we decided to call this program Tell Me More. It's for people who want to know more about the way we live now. So by now you might have heard the news that NPR has decided to cease production of this program after August 1st. Do I love this idea? No, I do not. But when the people who outrank you make a decision, you have two choices, salute or leave. I prefer to stay, and I hope that many of the people on the Tell Me More team will also stay so we can try to continue what we have started here, albeit on different platforms, as they say, telling you more about the way we really live now. There will be more to say on that in due course, but for now, you will find us here telling you more. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. You can now follow me on Twitter at Michelle McMartin. That's Michelle M-C-Q Martin. And this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.